Welcome to the Enneagram 2.0 podcast. I'm Beatrice Chestnut.
And I'm Urano Pais.
And today we're talking about one of my favorite topics, Dante's Divine Comedy and its connections to the Enneagram.
Right. I'm excited to ask you many questions about this, Bea, although I sort of know your answers because I've attended your wonderful course on Enneagram and Dante's Divine Comedy, which you do every year in June in Florence, in Locro, in Italy. So I plan to interview you, if you don't mind.
Sure, yeah. And even though you know the answers to my questions, hopefully people will find this as interesting as I do.
Yeah, and there are many specifics that you talk about that are lovely. So how did you get the idea to analyze the Divine Comedy in terms of possible connections with the Enneagram, or what brought you to this study and when?
Well, as an undergrad in college, I was an English literature major. I didn't start off in psychology. And so I've always been fascinated with analyzing literature and looking for themes. And I actually was really fascinated by the connections between Homer's Odyssey and the Enneagram, and the fact that Homer travels to these nine lands on his way home from the Trojan War in, sort of the epic, the Odyssey. And it's a allegory or a story about homecoming, coming home to the true self, and he stops at all these nine lands on his way home, and he deals with these different mythical creatures, all of which have thematic connections to the nine Enneagram types, and he travels to these nine lands in order of the Enneagram types themselves.
So did you read the Divine Comedy before knowing about the Enneagram?
No, I actually had never read the Divine Comedy.
Okay.
And I didn't read it in college, and I hadn't read it. It always seemed kind of complicated and hard to me, and so I think I had stayed away from it. But when I saw the connections between the Odyssey and the Enneagram, I thought, well, there's got to be something interesting going on in the Divine Comedy, because you have these different levels of hell, and you have lust and gluttony and, you know, some of these, you know, the passions that are there. And so wouldn't it be interesting to see if you could find the Enneagram, not only the types and the passions, but different kinds of elements about the Enneagram, especially as a path of spiritual transformation. And I kind of started off with the idea of, did Dante know the Enneagram? Mm-hmm. You know, now if he did, he might not have laid it out there, you know, completely in an obvious way, but it may have influenced the way he wrote, and it may be in there in different ways. So I thought, wouldn't it be great to read the whole thing and really look for the Enneagram and how it might show up there?
Right. So I understand you were talking first about a dimension of levels of awareness within the Enneagram, as we talk about in our model of levels of awareness. And there are the three books that he wrote as part of the Divine Comedy. So would you mind summarizing that for us?
Sure. Yeah, I think what you're saying is really true. And that is that we find the Enneagram in the Divine Comedy in two different ways. One is the types, or the different kinds of focuses of attention.
And I'll ask you about this in a while.
Yeah. Yes. But you also find the Enneagram in the Divine Comedy as a path of transformation, as a, like you're saying, almost like a movement up different levels of awareness through doing particular things. And one of the things that fascinated me the most was how the three books, or the three, you know, the three sections of the Divine Comedy, the Inferno, which is about hell, Purgatory, which is about the, you know, movement up Mount Purgatory, and Paradise, how these three books, to me, represent different states of consciousness. And the Inferno represents the state of consciousness when we're completely identified with our personality, and we're
right.
completely at one with our personality, it's a kind of hell. Even though, as you know, we often say, people at our level one, and we've done a podcast on levels of awareness in terms of the Enneagram symbol itself. But when people are at a low level of awareness, when they're completely identified with their personality, they can sort of think everything's fine, you know, in their life. Everything's working great. You know, there's no problem here. But and so in the Inferno, it's a little bit like that. The people are kind of doing their thing, but they're stuck in something really negative and painful for eternity.
Yeah, and it's even better because this is all written in poetry format. And whenever there is an archetypal description of our journey back to essence, when it's poetry, it speaks more the language of the soul. So there is something more unconscious in us that understands that in another level, right?
Yes, and thank you for mentioning that, because I think one of the things that's just amazing about Dante's work is it is this a masterpiece, a work of art. And one of the things that's really incredible about it is it's remained relevant for 700 years. This year, last year, 2021, was the 700th anniversary of Dante's death. And his, if you, I mean, again, it's not an easy read, but if you have a good translation and if you, you know, sort of take it slow and read the notes, the footnotes, you can really get a lot out of it. And the poetry of it and the characterizations, the story, the humor, there's so much in it in terms of being this work of art, this poem, this masterpiece of Western literature that recommends it just on its own. But then to have this incredibly powerful message about spiritual transformation, or maybe psycho-spiritual transformation might be a better way to put it, because I think the psychological is in there as well, even though, you know, it's a Christian poem. But he also refers to pre-Christian works of literature, history. So it's not just about a kind of Christian path. It is about that, but it's about much more too. It's a real timeless work that speaks to human transformation in general.
Yeah, timeless and sort of universal. Although
yes.
it uses Christian symbols, it also talks about a very broad narrative of the human journey. And I've just thought of something. He came not too much later than Rumi in life. Rumi lived like 800, 150 years ago. And, you know, sometimes I see a few correlations between things that they say in both in poetry format. But tell us more about those three books. I think that just mentioning them a bit more in practical terms for
yes.
us would be good.
Yes. So the Inferno, this trip through hell, and of course Dante goes through it as a living human, and his guide is Virgil. And of course, Virgil was one of Dante's heroes as a poet. And the fact that his guide is Virgil, and Virgil is pre-Christian, lived before Christ, is really important, because that's one of the ways he points back in time that this is something that is that does go far, far back in history. But the first one is about a state of consciousness, of unconsciousness, when we're really trapped in our personality, and we basically the shades in hell do the same thing over and over and over again for forever. And so it's like that's kind of like what we're like when we're in our personality, right? We do our same things over and over again, even though they don't work, even though they keep us asleep, even though, you know, they're in some ways they keep us in a state of suffering, but we kind of keep doing them because we don't do the work it takes to get to a higher level of consciousness. But purgatory is about what happens when someone wakes up, in essence. And decides in a way to do the work of transformation. And purgatory is all about what it takes to do that work. And so it, as they, the shades go up these, the terraces of Mount Purgatory, what they're really doing is working to become more conscious of the way they stay unconscious and aspiring or working toward the higher side or the higher virtue associated with their type. And so, one of the things I love about Dante is he really emphasizes that the work of transformation is difficult, but also attainable. And there are many things about purgatory that are fascinating that he, you know, renders as his story, but that tell us a lot about what Dante believes spiritual, psycho-spiritual development requires. So then when you do that work, so the state of consciousness of purgatory is the state of becoming conscious. And what it takes to go from a state of unconsciousness to a state of consciousness. And then paradise is all about the state of higher consciousness we can attain when we do that work, when we do what it takes to really get to that higher state.
Yeah, and then there are different terraces in purgatory that talk a lot about the work to be done by any Enneagram seeker or seekers in general. And those correlate a lot to what we talk about the work to be done with all of us. Just want to say that I confirmed here on Google, of course, and Rumi died 749 years ago, so pretty close.
Wow, I didn't realize they were so close to
Yeah. So, and
maybe it would be good to say a couple of things about Dante's life and death.
Yes,
and
please.
He wrote that, you know, what time period we're talking about. So Dante was born in about 1265. And he died in 1321. And he wrote the comedy, people think he wrote the comedy around 1300 until his death in 1321. And a couple facts about Dante's life. He lived in Florence, Italy. And of course, the course that I do every year, just to give a little ad for the course I do every year, the course I do every year in Florence, Italy in late May, early June, and we're doing it again this year after not doing it for 2 years of the pandemic, of course. The course we do every year is done in Florence because we do a 4-day workshop in Florence where we explore these interconnections between the Enneagram and the comedy and what it says about personal growth and our own personal growth journeys. And we spend some time in this beautiful classroom in this old convent in the venue that we have in Florence. And then we spend part of the day walking around Florence and visiting historical sites and learning about Dante's life and about what Florence was like. And so it's kind of amazing. But Dante was a poet, of course, but he was also a politician. And he was, you know, Florence at that time, Italy was a bunch of city states that were in a lot of conflict with each other. And I won't go into all the history, but basically Dante was exiled. The rival political group got into power and they say he was sort of framed, but exiled. And that was very painful for him because he loved Florence. So he spent the rest of his life after about 1300 in exile. And exile is a theme of the poem,
yes,
which of course we can see as our own exile from our true self when we're identified with personality. So it's, again, there's so many amazing themes and layers to it that we explore and that I think are there to be explored, but that's one of them.
And he's not even buried in Florence, right?
Yes, he died in exile. And it's funny, he died in Ravenna. And Florence tried to get his body back from Ravenna, but they haven't.
Yeah.
So his body is actually buried in Ravenna, even though there's a place that we visit that's sort of in one of the amazing, beautiful churches in Florence. Where they have a kind of monument to Dante, but he's not really there. And so he even remains in exile today. And so that's kind of something interesting.
Many times in history, unfortunately, people who reveal esoteric secrets on how to do inner work get chased down by formal institutions, including organized religions of all kinds, right?
Yeah, and the thing about Dante getting caught up in this political division and conflict and being exiled, it kind of is one of those things that tell us that his work is still relevant today, because of course we still have political divisions and conflicts and a lot of that caused by the human ego. And so what he's talking about in his, it's funny because he talks about a lot of the characters at the time. So it's almost like he gets the ultimate revenge by putting certain particular characters, popes, politicians, kings, historic figures, he puts a lot of them in hell. And sort of says why. And so
this sort of explains why he was exiled.
Yes, exactly. And pride is, of course, one of the big themes of the whole thing. And pride in Dante's scheme is the lowest sin in hell. It's the sin of Satan, who's, of course, at the bottom of the inferno. But again, there's so much, I mean, I could go on and on, so maybe you need to ask me another question, otherwise I'll just keep going off on tangents.
Well, yeah, I know, me too, because it's so interesting. And what was the most interesting thing you discovered?
It's hard to narrow it down to just one. I mean, one thing was that sense of, like, isn't this fascinating that these three books of the comedy represent these three states of consciousness? I think part of it was finding so much that did mirror the Enneagram. For instance, in Purgatory, you have the seven terraces, which match up with the seven deadly sins, which are seven of the passions, right?
And they're exactly the passions, right?
They're exactly the passions. They're not in order. You know, it's not like the Odyssey where you find them in perfect order, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
We should record another episode on the Odyssey sometime.
Yes, yeah. I'd love to do that. But they're not in order, they're in a different order, but I think the order he puts them in speaks a little bit more to what he wants to say about the spiritual journey. For instance, pride and humility are the first terrace of purgatory, and I think what he's saying there is, and of course pride is the lowest pit of hell, doesn't mean that twos are any worse than anybody else, of course, because pride is the passion of type two. You find that all the other passions in the inferno, of course, all the other types, you might say. But I think he's trying to say something about the process, Enneagram, or the process of transformation. And I think the reason why pride and humility, so on each terrace, the passion is there, but then the higher virtue is there also. And so basically what he's saying is the work on each of these terraces is to purge or become aware of and kind of empty yourself of the passion and aspire for its opposite, aspire to manifest more of this higher virtue. And I think the reason why he has humility as the first terrace is because all of us, I mean, I think what's really interesting about the way he depicts these things is on the one hand, we all have our main sin, what we might call sin, but of course sin if you really look at the etymology, is more about missing the mark, you know, the way that we were off base in life. If you look at the particular sin, they're all there somewhere, but the first thing that you need to work on is pride, because all of us, when we're identified with our ego, when our ego is driving the show in our life, when our personality is controlling us in a way, it's pride is kind of what keeps it in place. When we do the work of the Enneagram, when we do the work of saying, okay, I really need to look at the fact that I'm a 2 or a 4 or a 5 or a 7, what I really need to do is with a lot of humility, kind of step back and assess what I'm doing and see what's not so good. And it's a little bit like, you know, being, I think what he's trying to teach in the Inferno is really looking at what these passions, what these sins, what these preoccupations kind of keep us stuck in and how they do that. So that we can get out of it. You know,
yeah.
It's really about learning about, or Inferno is about learning about how you get stuck there to
yeah.
hopefully inspire you to do whatever it takes to get out of hell, to get out of that, that sort of vicious circle that
right.
every type is stuck in. And I think pride is something that it's almost like it keeps the ego fixed in place because we're all too proud to look at the ways that, we're maybe doing some not so good things in life, maybe to ourselves, maybe to other people. Like a lot of times we say that one of the characteristics of sort of not being able to be humble or to get beyond our personality is not being able to apologize.
Right.
The shades in hell, one of the characteristics of, they don't take responsibility for anything they do wrong.
Uh-huh.
They blame other people. Another interesting thing about the shades in hell is that they are not literally not present.
Mm-hmm.
They know the past and they know the future.
Yeah.
They can tell, they tell Dante things about the future, but they aren't, they literally aren't present. They don't know, they don't know what's happening in the present. They're caught up
and
in
they
something.
Walk in circles, right? And it's very different than Mount Purgatory where you're spiraling up.
Yes, you're spiraling down
yeah.
in literally Inferno and you're spiraling up. In purgatory, yes.
Right. And what does it take to get from Inferno to purgatory?
Yeah, one of the things I ask when I do the workshop of the participants early on is, what's the dividing line? You know, what, it's such an interesting question. What separates the people from Inferno and in hell and the people that go to purgatory? And by the way, if you go to purgatory, you will end up in paradise. So everybody that goes to purgatory ends up in paradise. It's just a matter of how long it takes you. And this is another thing I love, is he sort of poetically depicts everything about this, the psycho-spiritual journey. For instance, if you were really fixated, if you were really, if you did a lot of not so good things, if you were really asleep in your life, it takes you longer to get
yeah.
up Mount Purgatory.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah.
yeah.
yeah, and then you need to repent, right?
That's the thing. It's
yeah.
it's the dividing line, the difference is repentance
right.
in Dante's language. It's and to me, in Enneagram terms, what that means is becoming aware of how your personality is not so good
yeah.
and being able to step back and create space to reflect on that. So being able to self-observe
mm-hmm.
from a distance, creating that inner witness where you're not
right.
at one with the personality
yeah.
and you can see, wow. And again, not with a lot of criticism and self-judgment, but sort of saying, wow, what I did right there was a product of my ego.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't so good. And maybe I should find a way not to be compelled to do that same thing all the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Dante himself, when he left Inferno and got to purgatory, he couldn't pass the gate without Virgil's help.
Right.
And
well,
then
they,
what happened? What?
Yeah. So after they go through the Inferno, and we should say this is sort of a brief overview that we're giving
yeah,
today,
yeah,
just
course,
to
yeah.
give people a taste of what this. What this integration, this exploration of these interconnections is all about. But yes, they take this trip through hell. And, you know, we should say also that it happens at the beginning of it is Dante wakes up in a dark wood, right? So he's literally sleeping and he wakes up and he doesn't know where he is. He's gone astray. His life's not going well. And Virgil is sent to him to take him on this trip. And so they go through hell and then they go to, and of course the hell is this pit into the center of the earth. And then they kind of take this tunnel after they, and it's very dramatic. Like they see Satan at the bottom of hell because hell was created by the fallen Satan, the fallen angel, and whose sin is pride. And again, there's so much to say about all these
yeah,
things,
yeah, yeah.
but anyway, Dante comes out, Dante and Virgil, they kind of take this tunnel to the bottom of Mount Purgatory and they start approaching the mountain and Cato, who is the guardian of Purgatory, kind of comes out to meet them because he's the guardian and he says, hey, what are you
with
doing
a lot
here?
Of severity.
He thinks they may be escapees from hell, and so what are you doing here? And Virgil, who's just a really wonderful character in the whole thing, he says to Cato, you know, please allow him, basically he says, please allow him to come in. He, and this always moves me when I think about this, there's a beautiful line where he basically says, he comes in search of liberation.
Yeah, and then he's accepted
it. Yeah, and it just always really moved me that this is what it's, this is what this spiritual journey is all about. It's all about liberation. And of course, Dante's a living person who's taking this extraordinary trip through all these three realms, but he's doing it to learn about the consequences of staying asleep and the consequences of kind of going astray and all of what that means in each of our individual lives. And the benefits and the rewards of waking up, even though it's really hard. And that's what he's, that's what, one of the big messages of purgatory for Dante is that it's really hard to do the work of purging the personality and the passion, but it's worth it. And that's a lot of what paradise is.
Now, one of my favorite things is on the whole Divine Comedy and your workshop in particular is when it comes to techniques that are used for each, we could say Enneagram type even. Like you mentioned Chu, and there are particular techniques for Chus, like carrying stones, right?
Giant stones, So he goes up these terraces. Oh, and by the way, there's an anti-purgatory. There's a sort of a waiting room for purgatory where all the souls that took a long time to repent have to hang out before they even start the journey. And it's really interesting because the theme is very type nine. Mm-hmm. Like if like being sluggish or slow or having sloth is your passion, like, and again, it's
also the beginning of a new cycle. So it's, we are all nine in the new cycle on the Enneagram when we change stations of awareness.
Right, and it's also about how type nine is kind of the prototype for all of us who delay the journey, who don't make the decision to really wake up and do the work that it takes. And the longer you take to do that, the longer the journey takes. And that's one of the things I love about Dante is the whole idea of like, it's, everything is framed in terms of the perfect justice.
Right.
So in other words, if you were really bad in life, you have to work really, really hard in the afterlife.
Yeah, and also spend more time in one of the terraces. But
right.
Tell us about the thing about carrying a big stone for Chus.
So on the Terrace of Humility, when he gets there, and by the way, the work is done all done collectively in purgatory, so everybody's kind of on their own in hell.
Yeah.
But when you get to purgatory, everyone's doing it in a group.
Yeah, which talks about the Gurdjieffian concept that the group for spiritual awakening is not important, but utterly necessary.
Exactly. You see a lot of Gurdjieffian themes as you go through this. But he gets to the first terrace, and after being in anti-purgatory for a while, and the prideful, as it said, are carrying these giant kind of rectangular stones on their back, which means they're bent down and their faces are almost touching the ground.
Which is one of our mudras for type two. They need to bow, they need
to
look down.
Look down, because their noses were pointed up in the air as a symbol of pride in life. And so their noses need to be down toward the ground to teach them about humility. And the interesting thing is, the more prideful you were in life, the bigger your stone, right? The heavier your stone, so the more you're bent down. So again, there's this idea of justice.
And then for the envious, for instance, for force, their eyes would be so.
Yeah, their eyes are sewn shut with wire, and they're wearing burlap sacks, right? So they're wearing like something a four would never be caught dead in.
You can't differentiate.
No pun intended. But their eyes are sewn shut, so they can't look at other people and envy them, right? So, and on each terrace, you know, to make a long story short, that they also learn something about the passion and then learn something about the higher virtue. And so they're doing something, they're acting something out, they're purging the sin through this activity collectively, and then learning about the higher virtue as they do this.
And eventually all souls get to paradise.
Yes.
So tell us, towards the end of our podcast here, tell us about paradise, Mount Paradise, just to inspire all of us who are listening to you.
Yeah. I mean, paradise isn't a mountain. It's above the earth.
Yeah.
One last thing I want to say about purgatory before I say something about paradise, and maybe we can end on that. But purgatory is, I mean, what makes me see that he probably knew the Enneagram, and he, something that's very much about the types, is he says that everybody has to spend more time on one of the terraces that corresponds to what he calls their besetting sin.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody has a particular sin that was particularly big for them.
Yeah.
And so to me, it's like that's so much like the Enneagram types.
Yes.
Is we can relate to all of these types in one way or another. And sometimes you might have to spend like 100 years. Let's say you're a one. You know, you have to spend 100 years on the terrace of wrath.
Uh-huh.
But let's say maybe you also had some four stuff going on. Maybe you have to spend 50 years on the terrace of envy. But maybe only 10 or 20 years on all the other terraces. So it's a little bit like that is the way it's. The story is told, which makes me think about the types.
And I heard you say that you believe Dante was a two because he stayed longer in the terrace of...
Don't give away all the secrets.
Okay.
We need something for people to want to read the book about, although there's not a book about this yet.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's...
Although I think that also drawing from... Christianity in general and from Jesus's life, it makes sense that pride is a bigger sin because the teachings of Jesus are so much about humility.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
And I think with pride, I mean, wouldn't it be a humble act if Dante was a two to make pride his sin?
Yes.
The one that was the biggest problem in a way.
Yes.
But again, I think he's saying it's not that twos are have more problems than any other type. I think what he's really saying is pride is a problem for all of us.
Yeah.
And it's one of the things that keeps us unconscious the most.
Right.
And of course, the sin of Satan was saying I in front of the only one. It's the way we play God and don't realize it.
Yeah, and I think the whole work is humble. It's a sign of humility because he was talking about his journey and all the hardship and how he had to stay longer and how he depended on a woman, the love of his life, to guide him through and how she was more aware than him.
Beatrice,
right?
He equates Beatrice with love in many ways, and the way love is an activator, a transformer,
catalyst. Yeah.
It's a big theme of the whole thing.
But tell us about paradise.
Paradise. Well, paradise. I love paradise because it some of the themes are things that I often think about. Sort of a higher realm, and that is it's beyond human consciousness by definition. And that's a really big theme, is that it's unfathomable for us to really understand what paradise, what the higher state of consciousness is until we get there, right?
Yeah.
Like when we're, you know, in personality or even when we're in purgatory, we can't conceive of it.
Yeah.
So what paradise is it's something beyond human comprehension. It's sort of up there. But what happens is the spirits in paradise condescend to come down in these nine circles to teach Dante about paradise. And so it's like the paradise isn't really these nine circles, but it basically appears that way to him so that his human mind can take it in.
Mm-hmm.
And so he learns different things at each of these different levels of paradise, and these different levels of paradise represent different virtues and different aspects.
But also
of the
teaching
self.
To the lower centers of intelligence, as in Gurdjieff, like the lower mind, the human mind, as you said, like transforming that lower center to be able to open the higher centers.
Yes, there's a lot about what that takes.
Yeah.
And a lot of different kinds of lessons about how things look when we're in a higher state of consciousness.
Right.
To give just one idea, the first kind of spirit he talks to when he gets to that first level, and by the way, Beatrice becomes his guide in paradise. Virgil leaves him at the top of Mount Purgatory, and he meets Beatrice again, and there's a whole thing that happens at the top of Mount Purgatory before they go to paradise. But as they rise in different levels of paradise, Beatrice gets more beautiful.
Yes.
And her smile gets more bright. And at one point, like one of my favorite things is, she basically says to him, "I can't smile right now because it would blow your brains out. Like your human mind can't take in that much light."
Right.
But the first person, and I'll just, maybe we can just end with this, because there's a lot more to paradise. And of course, our intention here is to give kind of an overview and get people interested, because, and maybe we can do more on this at some point in some form. The spirit he talks to is someone he knew in life. He often meets people throughout the whole thing that he knew in life, that of course have passed by 1300, when the poem takes place on Easter weekend of 1300. And it's kind of timely that we're doing this podcast now, because we just had Easter a week ago, and we're doing the actual Dante workshop for the first time in 3 years. After COVID, coming up in early June.
Yeah, I just want to say that through the CP Enneagram website, you can find a link to know more information about the workshop you do in June.
Yeah.
So people who got interested can check that out.
Yeah. But this spirit that he meets at the first level, she seems kind of like a four. Her story is sort of four-ish. And he asks her, he goes, "Don't you feel bad kind of being down here at the lowest level of paradise?"
Yeah.
You know, it's such a human question. You know, we compare
mm-hmm.
and we look at who's higher or lower than somebody else.
Yeah, it's still the dual mind.
Exactly. And she basically says to him, like, "That's not the way we see it here." And she has a sort of one of the famous lines, "In his will is our peace."
Yes.
It's sort of like, it's God's will that things are the way they are. And we don't question, and we don't feel bad about it. We are where we are.
Yeah,
and
it's
we're
us.
All in paradise.
And it's us.
And it's us.
Not I and you.
Yes, right? Yes. And it's not really, these levels are sort of appearing to him in this way so he can learn. And again, it's all about learning about this whole process so that he can be inspired to do his inner work. And hopefully, of course, him as Dante, the poet, the author, can inspire other people to do their work through his work.
Wow, wonderful. I really enjoyed the talk, Bea, and thanks for doing this work of relating the Enneagram to Dante.
Well, I appreciate that you came 1 year, and that you are interested in this too, and that we can talk about this today. It's time for our top five.
What is our top five today, Bea?
Today, our top five is the top five types that like to travel the most.
Oh, this one was difficult for me to plan. You know, I wasn't so sure. How about you?
Yeah, I think it was hard to figure out who would like to travel. It was a little bit challenging.
You know, I won't talk subtypes or instincts here. I guess you won't either, right?
No.
Yeah, but I want to say that I think that socials travel more than sexuals travel, you know, in a different kind of trip.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that self-presses travel a little less than average.
Interesting.
But anyway, I talked about types only. So what is your number five?
So my number five is two.
Oh, okay.
I think twos aren't the biggest travelers, but I think twos like to have fun, and they like to meet people. And they, if they have friends in different places, they want to go, they're motivated to go be with them or do fun things with them. So I don't think they're the biggest travelers, but I think they do like to travel. So I'll put them at my number five spot.
Oh.
What about your number five?
Well, about the same reasons made me choose type six. I don't think they are the biggest travelers, but I think there is something about head types that are more curious about places and, you know, going to any, you know, to different places. Although I know there are different kinds of trips, like people who go always to the right place and one place. But yeah, I see that several sixes travel, but not among the most, the ones that travel the most.
Right, right. What about your number four position?
My number four is two, for the same reasons you talked about. Although I notice sometimes I've seen, not you, but I've seen other twos traveling, and many times they don't seem as interested in knowing places. You know, they are interested in knowing people. Other kinds of chews are interested in the food in the place.
That's very true.
Yeah. What about you? What's your fourth?
My number four position is five, actually.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I was thinking about types that like to have experiences and know things. And I think fives are motivated to go places to explore things they're interested in.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, going to museums or mm-hmm. going places to learn about things or going to different locations to learn about what it's like there.
Oh.
That's what I was thinking in terms of putting five at my number four position.
I see. So my number three is seven. I think that there is a paradox here. You know, many sevens like to travel, but I know so many sevens that don't travel at all.
Really?
Yeah, and it's because, like, their life, you know, feels like traveling all the time. You know, they don't need to go places to, you know, get pleasure and
they
fun.
They have fun wherever they are.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it surprises me, actually, when I see sevens not traveling much. But, you know, empirically, I just need to say, I know many sevens who don't travel and don't care much about traveling.
Mm-hmm.
It was a surprise to me first time, but I still see many sevens liking to travel. So yeah,
I see.
This is my third.
Okay.
What about you?
And my number three is one.
Wow.
For a little bit the same reasons I chose five. I noticed that some of the ones I know like to go particular places to explore particular things because they're deeply interested in it or... For instance, a lot of ones say they love to be in nature, you know, so going to the mountains or going to a particular place to see something spectacular.
Oh.
I find ones are often really motivated to go have experiences that are sort of educational, but also give them an experience of being somewhere really interesting or special. And I sort of think that we sometimes talk about how ones they don't really give themselves opportunities for pleasure or relaxation. But I think traveling, especially if there's an educational purpose to it or a nature element to it, I think traveling almost gives ones an excuse to have pleasure of a certain kind. And a lot of the ones I could think of that I know are very much like they love to plan a trip and make a point of going somewhere in particular.
I get your point. Maybe I should have included ones on my top five. But I'm curious to know, what is your second?
My second is type four, actually.
Hmm.
And this is because fours like to have special experiences. They're idealistic, and sometimes they'll get a picture of somewhere special in their mind that they want to go for a particular reason, and so they'll kind of make it happen.
Yeah.
And I think fours, in a way, like to experience the depth and beauty of life. And I think a lot of that can happen when you travel somewhere you've never been before or somewhere that's really wonderful for a particular reason. So when I thought about fours, I thought that they're motivated to go have that really unique or extraordinary experience through traveling. And also, I think going to see people that they care about or feel connected to.
Guess what? Type 4 is also my second.
We got one alike.
Yeah, and I think you explained most of it. And I would add that traveling, you know, differentiates people, and fours like to differentiate themselves. Also, the experiencing of new things. So I have a friend, for instance, who's a four, and he wants to travel to places not many other people go to. And, you know, it's wonderful to see his travel plans. And I just see that adventure, you know, just captivates fours at times.
Right. It's a little bit like life gets mundane and ordinary if you're not doing something special, or you don't have a special trip on the horizon.
Yeah. I almost put four on first place, but I have another one on first place. But you name first your number one.
Well, my first place is seven. I didn't see it so much as a paradox. I figured you thought, you know, it's a little bit the expected choice.
Yes.
But I do find that most sevens, if you ask them if they like to travel, they will say yes. And I think sevens really like the planning process for travel, the envisioning the trip, and then thinking of the different places they'll go. And it's almost like they experience the travel before they even leave in their minds.
Yes.
And so it's like the pleasure of that trip is both before and during.
And I just thought
of, you know, like when I do typing interviews and I talk to different people, a lot of sevens will say they really like to travel, and they like to go to a lot of different places.
Right.
And so, seven was my number one. What was your number one?
Do you guess?
Five?
Yay!
Really?
Really. Do you want to know why?
Why?
Well, first, empirically, I know so many fives, so many who love traveling. Maybe we have different samples and you see more fours or more sevens, but in my sample, fives really like traveling. And I'm one of those fives who loves traveling. And not anymore, but in the past, I used to, you know, see the meaning of my life as traveling. And what I notice with many fives is that when traveling, they can be really fun, relaxed, and quite different from who they are in their normal environments. And I realized that, at least for me, it's because we know the time we will come back. And then we have a timeline of allowing ourselves to have all that fun. You know, that horrible planning mind that we have, like budgeting the amount of fun we can have beforehand. And in a way, I think that traveling brings a lot of observation opportunities and learning opportunities. And you can be anonymous and at the same time participating in whatever you do. And when you travel, you run away from things in your daily life.
Ooh, wow, yeah. So I did have them on my list, but yeah, I can see why you remember
one spot. Great, this was fun.
Yes, it was. Thank you for listening. Join us again for our next Enneagram 2.0 podcast, where we talk about all things Enneagram.